Hi, I'm Jonathan Walsh. I'm from University of Washington, and I'm part of the large analysis team there, and made up of undergraduates, graduate students, and one person who's recently graduated. And we've had advisors of Steve Ellis and Matt Strassler, and the author of the box is Matt Strassler. So I'm going to talk about I'm going to do a quick analysis of the box, an unveiling of it, and then I'm going to go on to KT and cone jet comparisons using PGS-4. So what are the motivations behind Black Box A? It's a simple model. There's a lot of interesting features in it. It's an ideal learning tool, and it's good because it motivates developments of analysis techniques. And one thing is a nice bonus is it allows for investigation to detect detector effects and reconstruction algorithms. And this is a benefit due to the changeover from PGS-3 to 4 and this last Olympics. Okay, so what's the first look we're going to make? It's we want to fix our cuts. So objects in our detector below a certain PT cut have a low resolution and they may be inaccurate, so we're going to exclude them. And we make the following cuts. We're going to make no MET cut because we felt like the MET spectrum wasn't too large. And the lepton and the photons will have a 25 GeV cut, and the jets will have a 50 GeV cut on their PT. So the first thing we did was look at basic lepton and photon counters. And yeah, if you look at the dilepton events, you see a large number of E plus, E minus events. Sorry, there's a cutoff on this on our slides, but there's a large number of E plus, E minus events, and there's a large number of mu plus, mu minus events, but there's a small number of flavor mixing events like E minus, mu plus, or E plus, mu minus. And you see that there are a large number of 2 lepton and 1 lepton events, but not many 3 and 4 lepton events. And so this gives us something that we should look at. We should look at the invariant mass of these dileptons because this looks like there's a Z in the box. Just looking at the counters, and so we expect to see something there. And if you look at the photons, we actually think that this diphoton count is high because of the rate of photons goes as 1 over alpha per photon. So you expect only one diphoton event in this box, and we see 38. So if you look at these, we see a Z and a Higgs, just like the other groups. And the transverse mass plots and the dileptron counters show no evidence of W production, so we don't think W's are in this box. And if they are, that is at a very small rate. So we can see the Higgs and the Z in jets. And if you look at the 2-jet invariant mass, where the jets are close together, which we're assuming then that the Z and the Higgs are being boosted with high PT, so that their jets, when they decay, are close together in the detector, then these 2 jets will be close together. So we take a delta R cut of less than 1 on the 2 jets, and we see a peak of the Higgs and a peak of the Z. And it's also key to realize from this plot that the rate of Higgs and Z production is about the same. Okay, so now let's look at the jets. So there are large numbers of jets in the box, and there's an average of, these are jet counters, there's an average of 1 BTEC jet per event, and there's an average of 3 non-BTEC jets per event. And so we should look at how these jets impact the standard model decay products we've seen, or we've already seen in the box. So any new physics signal could involve the Zs and the Higgs, and also the jets. So we should look at combinations of Zs, Higgs and Zs, Zs and jets, Higgs and jets, and things like this. And so you see no features, except you do see the peak at 575, which we're going to call an X. So it's a new particle. And if you look at X, the decays of the X, X goes to 2 leptons in a B, gives a clearer peak than X goes to 2 leptons in a jet. So if we demand that the jet is tagged as a B, on the right you see a better peak than on the left. And this is going to be important. So we think that the X is actually decaying to a Z plus a B here. And any X decays where it goes to a jet is just a mistagging. And so you see the same thing in Higgs plus jets. When X goes to a Higgs plus a jet, you also see the Z peak. And we make, to form the Higgs, we make a delta R cut on the 2 jets to be less than 1.0, and we make a 10 G. The 2 jets must have an invariant mass, but within 10 GeV of the Higgs mass. So we look for evidence of X pair production, and you see it. So when you look at the x goes to two leptons and a b, the invariant mass of the rest of the event, all other objects that pass our PT cuts, there's a peak at the x mass, and that's at 575 GeV. So we are satisfied that there is pair production of the x. So there's a basic model, and it's that you have x pair production where the mass is around 575 GeV, and you see the two, you see two decays. You see x goes to z plus a b, and x goes to Higgs plus b. And this could be everything in the box, because we see no other resonances in the model or otherwise. And so we want to look in at types of models that this could be. And so we want to come up with a model for what the x is and estimate the branching ratios, simulate this process, and compare it to the black box. So what is the x? Well, it decays into a B quark plus a colorless and neutral object, the Z and the Higgs. So it's got to carry B quantum numbers. And the dileptal encounters indicate that this decay X goes to W plus top is suppressed, and we don't see any multi-W events. If we did, then we would see a lot of three lepton events, L plus events, E mu events, and they're just not there. So we don't think there's a lot of W's in the box, especially in multi-W events. So the simplest model that we could come up with is one which the X is a new quark, and we're going to call it the B prime. So it's just a fourth generation quark. So let's see how this fits into the standard model. So if you look at the quarks in the third generation, you have the left-handed top and B, and there's a standard SU2, U1, and SU3 charges, and the right-handed quarks as well. So we want to put the left-handed B prime in, and the left and the right-handed B prime in. And we know since the left-handed B prime decays into a left-handed B plus a charged neutral object in these groups, then it has to have the same quantum numbers as the left-handed B. And the right-handed B prime is going to have the same quantum numbers as the right-handed B. So the only thing is now, what is what else goes with the B prime? And that was the crux of the Stanford black box. And since you don't see the decay into a top, then your natural the natural direction you lead is that it is an isosinglet, that it's by itself. And that's what the conclusion we came to. And so we have this model where you have a isosinglet left and a B prime, and it's antiparticle. And this was the model that we came up with. So we decided to simulate, or to estimate the branching ratio, and then do the simulations, and we're going to unveil the box after this. So there's a couple ways to estimate the branching ratio. Higgs to gamma, gamma is a good way, just because it's you can easily distinguish it, but it is sensitive to new physics. You could have heavy particles running around in the loop that will change the branching ratio of Higgs to gamma, gamma. So we're going to go away from that and go to Higgs goes to BB. And this is less sensitive because the decay rate is so large, and so it's ideal for determining the branching ratios. And the decay of z goes to two leptons is going to give a lower bound on the rate of b prime goes to z plus b. So we're going to use these two decays to give an upper and lower bound on the rate of b prime goes to z plus b, and it'll be a nice range of rates. So a lower bound, it comes from the dileptal events. So if we factor in the number of events, which is about 18,000, the number of dileptal z's which pass our cut is about 700, and the decay rate going to two leptons, and then we can include the probability of missing a lepton, which is given by this ratio of one lepton to two lepton events, we get a lower bound on the rate of B prime goes to Z plus B. And that rate is at least 7, and the error is about 0.2, 0.19. Okay, well, there's another way to estimate that. We need an upper bound on the rate of B prime goes to Z plus B. And so if you remember this plot, we have invariant mass of two jets where the jets are within delta R of 1.0, and you see a Z and a Higgs in this plot. And we said before that this indicates that the branching ratio of whatever it is, or the production rate of Z's and Higgs is the same. And this is what's going to give us a bound. So we just put a combinatoric background in that's kind of generous, and we estimate the number of events in the Z peak and the number of events in the Higgs peak, and you get 530 events in the Z peak and 270 events in the Higgs peak. So if we assume that the branching ratio is 100% from Higgs goes to jet, then this is going to give an upper bound of the rate, because whenever we push this branching ratio down, we're actually pushing the representative number of Higgs in that peak up. And if you calculate this out just with common torques, you get an upper bound of about 0.8 plus or minus 0.1. So what are we left with? We're left with a range of branching ratios for the B prime goes to Z plus B, and it's between about 50% and 90%. And the thing to take away from this is that the branching ratios are on the same order. And so what's next is to simulate this model with Pythium PGS and see how this compares with the data in the black box. And so we do this, and in our analysis we do this, and we find that if you simulate it, it's consistent with 70% goes B prime goes to C plus B, and 30% goes to Higgs plus B. And that's what's in the box. So you can find the card at this website, and it's a B prime fourth generation isosinglet quark goes to Z plus B 70% of the time and Higgs plus B 30% of the time. Okay, so that is that part of the analysis. So we're going to move on now to look at the KT and CONJET algorithm. So the black box is a great study tool for the KT and CONJET algorithms. And this kind of comparison is really what we need to, the type of things that are going to have to be done at the LHC on a much bigger scale to learn about these two JET algorithms and characterize them. And so this is a good setting to test this, because there's a lot of events with many JETs. There's a lot of hard JETs from the B prime decay, and there's a lot of soft JETs from the Z and Higgs decays. And PGS3 is going to use the CONJET algorithm, and PGS4 implements the KT JET algorithm. And so the caveat here is that we're using PGS3 to simulate data with the CONJET algorithm, and PGS4 to simulate data with the KT algorithm. And so any differences come with the important caveat that it's also the differences between PGS3 and 4. And so the thing to take away from this is that these problems you'll see significant differences, but you can't draw any significant conclusions besides these problems are really worthy of further study. And so when we first received this data box, this black box from Matt, we received it in PGS3 before the black box was released. And so we have a nice data sample with PGS3 and PGS4 to compare. So if we look at the counters between PGS3 and PGS4, if you look at the one lepton counters, on the left is always going to be the cone jets in PGS3. On the right, it's always going to be the KT jets in PGS4. And so the number of one leptons in PGS3 is, if you look at the taus, it's at a much higher rate than with PGS4. And you actually expect the rate you see on the left with the cone jet with PGS3, because you have Higgs decays to tau, and you also have the Z decays to tau. So that rate on the left is consistent. And on the right, you see a low reconstruction rate for the taus, and it's about a factor of 6, which is significant. And same thing with the Bs. You see about a 25% reduction in the number of B jets in the two events. So you have about the same number of total jets, but your B jets goes down by about that amount. And in this sample we analyzed, it's a 10 inverse femtoborne, so it's 9,500 events. Okay, so let's look at the single jet invariant mass spectrum. And this plot was shown before. In it, you can see the Z peak, and you can also see hints of a Higgs peak. And on the right, you have the KT algorithm, and on the left, you have the cone jet algorithm. And so this is the jet mass for all jets with a PT of bigger than 100 GeV. And you see the Higgs peak or the Z peak much better with the cone jet algorithm with the KT algorithm. And you see a shoulder at the Higgs of 115 GeV with both algorithms, but it's much more distinct in the CONJET. And so there's you can see the smearing between the two algorithms. So we also looked at the number of tracks in the CONE and KT algorithms. And so we plotted the number of tracks on the y-axis versus the jet mass on the x-axis. And this is against single jets. And so the y-axis scale, you can't see on the left, but it's the same as the one on the right. And so you see a lot more events with high numbers of tracks in the KT algorithm, which this is, comes from, we think, merging of jets and collection of tracks than with the cone jet algorithm. And you can also see clusters in these plots at the Z peak, and you see a drop off right after the Higgs mass, and it's clear, as you note on the left. It's also something to take away is that you have very few events with low numbers of tracks in the KT algorithm. So the jet resolution decrease in the KT algorithm can lead you to missing a physics signal. And in this box, the Z peak is very clear, and you can see it very well in the cone jet algorithm, but not as well in the KT jet algorithm. So here we're plotting the jet PT versus the jet mass for single jets again. And on the y-axis is the jet PT, and the x-axis is the jet mass. And so you see a nice clustering of the distribution in the jet PT versus jet mass in the cone jet algorithm, with a clear bunch of the Z peak and like a shoulder at the Higgs mass. But in the KT jet algorithm, you see a much broader distribution. And what's important is that you see a lot of events with high invariant mass but very low PT. And so this is a symptom of, I think, over-merging, where you have jets that are very broad in the detector, and the PT is balanced out by the actual geometry of the jet. Whereas in the cone jet algorithm, the jet size is fixed, and so you can never have, I mean, it's very rare to have jets with high mass and low PT. Okay, so question, this thing that came up with during John Conway's talk is tau reconstruction, and so the taus seem kind of lonely in the KT jet algorithm. If you plot the delta R between the tau and the nearest jet, if you look at the cone algorithm, there's a nice sharp rise at 0.7, which is the cone size, and it a falling distribution after that. But in the KT jet algorithm, there's a much slower rise. And so you suffer from statistics due to the sample size, because you have much fewer taus in the KT jet algorithm. But on the other hand, you can't see the slow rise. So it's almost as if the tau is not isolated enough, then it's being passed on as not a tau and it's being collected into a jet later on. So if you remember, John Conway put up this ordering of objects they went through. So it was gamma, electron, tau, and then jet. And so if you think that the tau is, if it doesn't pass your isolation cut, then it might be passed on to the jets and absorbed into one of the jets. And so you're only left with those taus that are really lonely in the detector. And so, so here's some conclusions to take away. And remember that the caveat is that you're coming with the PGS3 and 4 differences here. So a lot of these we really need to study and think about what's a PGS3 to 4 effect and what's a KT algorithm effect. So you tend to have a much broader distribution in your KT jet characteristics, where they have low PT and high mass in the KT algorithm, but that you don't really see that in the cone algorithm. And this can lead to poor reconstruction of resonances and other features, especially if you put in standard model backgrounds and things like that. And you also see a smearing of the mass spectra, PT and mass spectra in the KT algorithm. And one of the more interesting aspects is tau reconstruction, but this is most likely a big combination of the PGS 3 to 4 effect and the KT algorithm effect. So we are really looking forward to doing more study on this. And that's all.
I never take a concept.
Well, this is the same thing that
This statement is not correct. The statement that it's not that it's infrared safe is not correct, and I can't answer that because but my colleague Steve Ellis can answer that, since he invented the algorithm. On this particular issue, because I listen to Steve on a regular basis, I think I have it right. So it's subtle. The reason, so the original cone algorithm, as defined by the Snell-Mass cone discussions back some years ago, is completely infrared safe. There's no issue there. The issue of infrared sensitivity, which is not the same as infrared safety, comes in when you start trying to introduce seeds, because the original cone algorithms were seedless. You just search throughout the detector. There's no problem. So the issue is when you start to only look under the lamppost, you can have effects where if you have one parton going over on one side and nearby you have, but not too far away, you have a parton going on another side, so it's the next leading order effect. Now you stick a third parton in the middle and you use that third parton as a seed, so it's the next leading order effect. Then you can be sensitive to what the cutoff was on your seed, on the PT for that seed. And that's the source of this whole debate as to whether cone jets are infrared safe or not. But it's not infrared safety, it's infrared sensitivity to that seed. So if you just make sure your seeds have a PT, that your cutoff on how low a PT is for the seeds that you use, then you don't get into a problem. So there seems to be a lot of confusion over this point. It is confusing, but it's not infrared safety in the sense that infrared safety would say if I radiate a softer collinear gluon, I get senseless answers for this cone algorithm. It doesn't suffer from that. If you have a... If you allow for seeds at 5 GV and you get a gluon at 5 GV, then yes, that could have a big effect. So put your PT cut for seeds higher, and then the probability of that goes extremely low. So, right. So the way the cone algorithm was originally defined was look throughout the detector and put cones everywhere and let them settle down after, you know, look, finding places where they're stable and so forth. This is somewhat expensive in terms of computer time. So a faster algorithm is find places where the cones are likely to be stable in the first place, put a cone there, and try to find it. But then that introduces various problems that the original algorithm didn't have. So it all comes from the seeds and exactly how they're implemented. And it is true that if you allow seeds which are very, very soft, then cones can jump around, you get into some trouble. So don't do that. Yeah, it's basically a place in the calorimeter where there's a bunch of energy and there's some reason to think there might be some jet nearby. So now, particularly at the LHC where, I mean, defining jets with PT much below 30 or 40 GV is probably going to be pretty tough, certainly with any reliability. It's not going to arise. Do we have any experts on this here? I don't think we do. It's a problem. That I do not know the answer to. I mean, I'm not... I think KT has many advantages in E plus E minus, which it doesn't have. And the underlying event really screws things up, for example, and the beam pipe. There's a lot of things. But having said all this, I'm not expert enough to understand exactly what the subtleties are, but I know that the experimentalists are setting themselves up to do both. That is to say, the reconstruction software is going to provide them with a list of a variety of different things. And presumably for different types of analyses, different ones will be preferable. If you're trying to reconstruct a mass peak, KT is probably not as good. If you need some very accurate prediction or quantities where you have isolated enough jets that the merging is not as big a deal. Probably K2 we've got, but it may be something we won't know until we really have more studies that actually come. Because right now we don't have enough CDF and D0 studies using KT, so we don't really know, I think, from data what the issues are. Is that fair, John?
I just want to say that the KT algorithm is born out of E plus E minus detectors and heurists, where the underlying event is almost nothing in E plus E minus collisions, but in PP collisions it's much larger, and so you have this tendency to want to, the algorithm wants to include soft things, and so it tends to collect soft jets into larger jets, and so you get these large jets which can have, you know, low PT because their geometry is sort of bizarre, but you I mean, that's really where the difference comes from. It's not, I mean, the motivation in the algorithm is, you know, not, it's not from, it's from the, it's from E plus C minus collisions. It's not, you know, necessarily a worse algorithm than Cone. Cone was used at the Tevatron, you know, originally, and it's very useful on its own. So I wasn't trying to, you know, say KT is bad, but it's worth studying to see what the differences between the two are, and this is a good method to do that.
It's not that fast. What's giving you the decay is D conjugate Higgs dagger Higgs D. The vertex is not a normalizable. So there's two things. And of course, it's okay because this is the only thing that's making this particle decay. So this scale would be an IUPAC, and you wouldn't know. So it's actually a good illustration of sort of bottom up. Effective theory making two things. First of all, entropy across the one invariant isn't a good guide in thinking about, I mean, but it's a kind of singular, slightly singular example for that in this case. But just because you have something that goes to UV doesn't immediately mean there's nothing that goes to that. And secondly, that the things that give rise to So this is a question. Of course, you can get this from using this is from the model of fourth generation, and you integrate out the rest of the fourth generation. But it's just
there are also operators like But
from the bottom up point of view, the important point is that we're used to thinking about the decay of all these. And so it doesn't have to be, in fact, you just say that it's
E is a
right. Yeah, I mean, sorry, that's
E. E is
D right. Ordinary, I'm sorry. So D is the mean, D is the new particle.
Of course, I mean, to be fair, it's a 70% to 30% direct subtraction to get the fine tuning, the whole fine tuning is quite obvious. And I want to design something that would be. But you can prove it if you have enough time. So that's what's unusual about this example. It's such a minimal particle function, you could actually force the subtle point. It's a single case, it's possible to use the data to do a non-normal. And so it's not so easy to mock this up if you're trying to do something afternoon to mix, but if it's mixing, it can't mix with its normalizable interaction, because otherwise it gets to W. So if you're just a dumb guy, then that's what you do, you can unnormalize the process. Fun to try to build a model.